ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our great guest is Michael Bugby, the founder of Expedited Security, and we're going to talk about all aspects of security for websites and web applications. This episode is brought to you by Lightmatter. Have you ever wondered how top companies ship new features so quickly? Or have you ever struggled to get that awesome UX and UI you were going for? That's where Lightmatter comes in. They act as direct extension of design and development teams at some of the world's top companies. Whether your company needs a new brand, website, or app, they can help. Check them out at lightmatter.com/UIbreakfast to learn more. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks so much for your time and for bringing up this important topic for us.
I'm very happy to be on this, in part because for a long time, I've really felt that a lot of security issues are actually UI issues. And I know not everything is, but I feel like there's a lot of times that security issues happen and it's almost like a blame the users thing, when in fact the user experience overall was incredibly confusing, or just that the expectations are out of whack or other things. And so I've just always felt that it was a really neat intersection of that, where there's so much that the UI and UX community and practitioners can really help improve the security of everyone online.
That's definitely so. But before we get started on that, could you give us an overview of the last 10 decades that you've been into security and the story of your products, because all of them have been related to that?
I was a consultant freelancer for a long time and worked in a number of different companies. And a real through line from all of those was that they struggled with security. And so this includes I worked for the US Navy. I worked for 3M Health Information Systems, which is software for hospitals. So worked in a lot of high security regulated environments, as well as a lot of startups and other areas. And across all of these, security was always an issue. And so one of the first products I had was helping get SSL or TLS certificates installed, the HTTPS on websites, in a really rapid, and more than that, a very consistent manner that didn't rely on the person having to suddenly bring on a whole bunch of knowledge and make a lot of decisions that, in a lot of ways, the success of that service was around the user experience. And now I'm doing something similar with web application firewalls, where the web application firewall is like a shield or a net, that's in front of your application that's automatically catching all sorts of attacks and threats that would hurt your application and you would need to really think about or counter. And this is just doing it for you.
Is it a software product, or do you also offer services about it?
So all of these are SaaS things, where it's, a monthly ongoing service to take care of that for you. And in the case of Expedited WAF, which is the web application firewall, it really is, it's a network of servers around the world in different locations that, traffic requests as they come in are filtered at those and then brought to your actual application. So if there's a request that looks like it might have an issue with it, that it has something that matches the pattern of, say, a SQL injection attack, where, it's asking for hey, give me the information related to this user, but then it adds in a single quote and an extra bit of SQL. Well, this would detect that and stop it before ever touching your application.
Sounds like a very, very useful service. So how do you go around convincing web application owners that this is absolutely necessary?
Well, it's tough. And it's tough for weird reasons. I think everyone, when you talk about it, oh, yeah, that sounds useful.
That's what you say to a friend.
Well, I think anyone who's a developer, the state of the internet and how it is, everyone has to be concerned about security at some level. And in most of the frameworks, so I know you've worked with our friend Benedict, and he does Rails work. And so Ruby on Rails has a number of conventions and setups that help stop SQL injection attacks. And so if you follow those very closely and there's no issues with the underlying framework, you're safe, more or less. But it's very easy to make a mistake, to misconfigure something, there's a constant release of new updates to the frameworks that you have to integrate. And so in most scenarios, you don't want just one thing protecting your data. You want multiple levels. And that's referred to as defense in depth, so that there's multiple different ways for an attack to be stopped. And by combining those, you have a system that's much, much more secure than any one defense.
What's your current opinion about most of the web applications that we see these days? If I'm allowed to ask this question, because you must have seen a few. Can you evaluate that as an external person, or do you have to be an involved consultant to understand that this popular app is not secure and another one is?
It's very hard to tell from the outside. There are dedicated people that do, and they're called penetration tests. And so you would hire an outside firm or individual to say, come in and evaluate the security of the application. And, you know, they would go through and check for all these things and give you a report on things you can do to, a lot of times it's very basic housekeeping stuff like, oh, you want to make sure your server's patched. And also sometimes it's, you know, oh, we found this weird exploit in this one library you're using that, you know, handles file uploads, that lets people upload an arbitrary file. And if they do that, then they can access it remotely and then maybe extract data or use that as a foothold to get further into the system.
And what's the state of the sort of community security culture? Do you think most of the founders that we know are doing a great job on that, or is there always area for improvement?
I think there's always areas for improvement, whether or not that means they need to buy a web application firewall and pay me money every month is kind of separate from that. And I try to be realistic about it, in that most of the time, if there's a SaaS application, you'd have, say, a marketing site, and then you have an application site. And you kind of do a little basic threat modeling. Oh, what's the threat to the marketing site? Well, no one's really trying to break into it and steal users' credit card information. But on the application side, oh, that's actually a bit more of an issue. And so it makes more sense to have something there. And so what I really see is that, and this shouldn't be a shock to anyone, that I think people try to make rational decisions. And they say we're pretty small. We don't have that much data. We don't really collect that much data in the first place. That we try to be compliant with GDPR, which is the big European privacy regulation that everyone should try to be compliant with. And, there's a new one called CCPA, which is the California Consumer Privacy Act, which may affect quite a few more startups and things. But, there's this whole set of things that really boil down to just being responsible. And so in general, responsibility for a SaaS application is, try your best to, do good security practices, to keep as little data as possible, only what you need to handle user data access requests, that if a user asks hey, what data do I have that you're able to provide that? And that's more data privacy than security, but that you're responsive to that and that you're keeping the application up to date and handling security reports and things like that.
Are there any public resources, maybe books or respectable forums there where you can trust these resources as, sort of a textbook on this topic?
So there's an organization called OWASP, and I always forget what the acronym stands for. It's one of those big OWASP.org.
We'll link to that in show notes for sure.
Open Web Application Security Project. It has a cool name, OWASP. But so every year they publish what the OWASP Top 10, which is very practical. You're asking for practical. And it is the reported vulnerabilities from non-framework level. So it's things like SQL injection attacks. All the members of the foundation sort of get polled and they say, here's the things we're seeing. Here is what we're experiencing as an ongoing problem, and that you as a founder, you as a person who's making software, should be aware of. And it's things like not filtering inputs properly, which could lead to a SQL injection attack, or things like that. So it's a good starting point if you're interested in this, the OWASP Top 10. So.
Great, thank you. We're going to link to that in the show notes. So I'm not an expert in security. Therefore, I'm not super qualified to bring up certain questions, but thanks to you, we have an agenda of certain considerations that we could discuss here. So let's do that in sort of blitz style. And you have a lot to say, I can tell, looking at that agenda. And you outlined a few general problems of cybersecurity, passwords, AWS breaches. So tell us about some of that.
You know, I mentioned before, I think there is a general UI problem with things. And so AWS, which is Amazon Web Services, is, of course, incredibly popular. And one of their most popular services is S3, which is their data storage. And so they're almost all of the Amazon services either pull data from S3 or they write data to S3. You can imagine a scenario where someone like has a bunch of data in a database and they're going to run this huge report and then it's going to spit out that report into an S3 bucket. Well, the S3 buckets have users on them. You can assign rights to them, who can read it and who can't. And a very common mistake in that leads to huge data breaches has been around the concept of who can access that bucket. And it's entirely unclear from the UI whether it's anyone on the internet or anyone who is connected to AWS or anyone that is in your account, like your organization. Like, that's a very blurry line. And this has huge ramifications where it says any authenticated user. Well, it's anyone who logs into AWS. And certainly if you're, you know, a healthcare organization and you've done this massive cancer study and it's online, or you're doing a report of everyone who has, you know, a credit card that's failed to process that month and it's sitting in S3 and you misconfigure that, well, there's bots now that just trawl through every S3 bucket looking to see if they can just pull data out of, and it happens all the time. And that's one of those things where it's not encryption and it's not passwords. It's a user interface problem that has led to very directly to all of these different data breaches. So,
what are the alternatives? Shall we just be aware how that UI works so that the developers can fine-tune those settings? Or is there just overall another data storage solution that you should pursue?
Well, I think it's a problem across everything. I'm not trying to pick on AWS in particular. And in part, there's been a lot of AWS S3 data breaches because the system is used a lot that, you know, you don't hear about other ones as much just because they're not used as much, though it may be happening at the same frequency. I think it really is a UI problem, and that you have to be, you know, very aware of all these things and take it into account and test. But even so, I think it's very, we're human. These things are complicated. And from that, it's just very easy to make mistakes. So
whenever there is a UI problem, well, there are two sides to it. One is the side who makes mistakes, that is the user, but the other one is the creator of that UI. So is that the AWS S3 UI that's causing trouble? Could they do better with like better presets or defaults on that?
Yes, and it has improved a lot. And AWS has taken other precautions, like they'll actually email you now if they think that your AWS 3 bucket is misconfigured. Another very common thing that comes up and that we have had friends this has happened to is that, you know, they're like, hey, I would like to learn more about development. So they get a GitHub account and they get an AWS account and they're going to put up a blog on S3 bucket. Like, very common workflow. And so they go about and they set it up and they push it out, and then they get a bill for like $20,000 from AWS. And what they didn't realize they were doing was they accidentally checked in their keys to that S3 bucket as part of their project. And it was in GitHub and it's an S3, and bots went through, found those AWS keys, and then used them to mine Bitcoin on other Amazon instances and ran up a huge bill.
Oh, no. Is there a way to repair the situation?
Well, this happens enough that AWS basically now just goes, oh, yeah, right, your credentials got stolen. And they credited back the thing. We're not going to charge you, you know, $20,000 for a 5-page blog about, you know, typography. But that happens. And so now there's lots of other checks, like GitHub will actually like look through your account and like, this kind of matches what looks like could be an API key. We're going to hide that. Oh, this doesn't look right. You need to make sure you're not doing that. And so it's a mix. And I think the industry is constantly learning and constantly paying the price for those lessons to learn more about security and to take it into account. A through line of this is that I think there's a common misconception, which is that you think of like hackers, you think of like they're attacking you. And you're like, I'm putting up this static website that talks about typography. There's no security aspect to it. But what has happened is that there are just constant thousands and thousands of bots scanning every single system, every single SaaS, every single website they can get hold of, looking for security vulnerabilities. So, you know, we talk about, you know, some of the services that you've run, and they're built on Rails. Well, certainly that means they're not built on WordPress, but I am positive that every day there are dozens and dozens of requests for your domain /WP-admin, because that's an incredibly common bot that just looks for WordPress pages, tries default passwords, tries to get into them so they can update them with spam and spammy links and things. I guess just that sense of like, even if you're not doing something that you think would warrant attention, there's still a security component to it because there's all these automated attacks.
That sounds really scary, but that's the world we're living in. A couple more issues that you've written down were passwords in general and especially plain text passwords. So your words on that.
This is an interesting thing where, like, what do you consider secured? And so for a long time, when people were making a SaaS application, they would write their own security, and there you log in with like an email address and a password, and that password would be kept just as any other text, like the same as like a job title in the database. And so if you're the developer, you could have gone into the database and looked through it and said like, oh, here it is. And so now there's better ways to handle that. Probably too technical to get into here, but but suffice to say, there's better ways to handle that, and that's maybe a tell for services whether or not, you know, they're secure. And there's like public name and shame sites for like, hey, you're not encrypting your passwords properly and things. So
let's talk about HTTPS and how that has come over in over a few years. Suddenly all the sites are secure thanks to modern browsers, which require that. So could you give us an overview how that protocol has evolved and appeared, and how long has it been out, and how it has been promoted into mandatory?
I put in the notes here that I think it's mostly due to Edward Snowden. And I don't know if anyone else thinks about this, but, you know, Edward Snowden, you know, he was a contractor working for the NSA, and he had this big, you know, release of data that was previously classified. And one of the things that he released was that there was massive data collection projects happening across the internet. And two, that SSL was a major hindrance to that happening, that having a site be, you know, secured was a major. It raised the cost, it raised the complexity, and messed up all sorts of things in trying to just scoop up all the data in transit and, you know, monitor it for things. And so a lot of the big services in Silicon Valley, among them Google, saw that and really started to push every site should be secured and should have SSL on it. Whether or not, and we sort of talked about like, yeah, like a tiny blog, does that need SSL necessarily? And well, the answer is, well, if everything is SSL, we're all safer in all these different ways. And so they in part funded Let's Encrypt. And Let's Encrypt has by far the best fundamental UI of any SSL installation service, better than mine, better than can be achieved differently, because they were able to sort of invent this from the ground up. And I think is a really interesting mix of like the true user experience of getting it set up and kind of getting out of user's way and making things happen in a very positive way. But in the mix of all that, it has become the default that every site now has SSL. And an interesting aspect of that is how it's communicated to users, where there's a constant tension of like, well, what does a site being secured actually mean? Does it mean you're going to the correct site? Maybe not. Maybe it does. Does it mean the information that's transmitted over the wire is secured? Yeah, much more so. And that tension and the tension of how that should be represented in the browser. And it's changed a lot over the years, where initially, if you were SSL, it was kind of special. Like if you were looking and there'd be like tips online, like, hey, if you're checking out before you put the credit card in, make sure it has the bright green lock and says secure on it. Like that was a thing like 5 years ago. And so that's been deprecated to now it's a situation where the secure is the default. And so if you have SSL on your site, it has a little lock, but it's all gray. If you don't have SSL, it says, oh, this site is insecure in bright red letters. And so it's shifted the focus of it to where they're trying to bring the rest of the internet along to a place where, you know, we're all more secure.
Could you maybe make a couple steps back for the less technical people and just explain what SSL is and how it works, if that's possible, in a couple minutes?
There's a really clever bit of math called public key encryption, which is that you have two keys, one of which can be used to encrypt things. The other key, the private key, can be used along with that to decrypt them. And by deploying these keys in a particular way, you can help make sure that communications are to the proper site. And this concept of like public key encryption is used in lots and lots of security products in lots of different ways. And so one of the ways it's used is with SSL. SSL stands for Secure Sockets Layer, and it's the general term for having the lock in your browser and the secure communications between the site you're connected to and your browser. And by setting this up, you basically are exchanging these keys and a certificate and things such that it's like a conversation that happens really rapidly where that's agreed upon. And then from that point on, all the rest of the communications take place within that. If you're familiar with like a VPN, if you've heard that, a lot of people use VPNs to like watch Netflix in other countries and things.
Oh, yes, I do this all the time. We should probably talk a bit about VPNs too now. Please keep going.
But I was going to say, SSL is almost like VPN for one website. That each website you go to, it's almost like a VPN between you and that website that gets reestablished and brought up and brought down each time. So it keeps your information secured, you know, across it. So other people like your ISP have a much harder time of like peering in at it, but they still know there's a connection that's happening.
Let's talk about VPNs. So it feels like such an interesting industry where in some countries, and let's not get into politics, please, it's the only way for a person to effectively function online. So, but it also feels like it's borderline legal, not exactly illegal, but definitely not a transparent model. So how does it work? What does it mean? And what's your opinion about the future of VPNs in the world?
I know your audience, I think, is interested in like a lot of software applications and things and making projects. I actually had registered the domain like rollyourownvpn.com that was going to let you like one click make your own VPN on like AWS or Azure and, you know, use that as a connection and things. And I gave it up because I felt like the people who are like really into VPNs and things, that it's a very kind of toxic and weird community. Not like the everyday users, but like the people, like the industry itself is kind of weird. And I think you're saying it's like quasi-legal, and it does kind of feel that way. And I think that's because there's multiple uses for VPNs. One is that especially pre-SSL everything, it was a lot more difficult to figure out if you would be secure, like if you're at the airport, that you bring out your laptop, you're on the communal Wi-Fi, you're trying to connect back to things like, is this actually secure? Are people looking at my traffic? Are people attacking this? And still VPNs help a lot with that. So that is a very above the board kind of thing. VPNs also, and this is where I feel like some of the marketing around them gets a little weird. Certainly they shield your ISP from knowing exactly where your traffic is going, but in part you're trading that to the organization. So if you have, you know, XYZ VPN service, XYZ VPN service knows all the sites you're going to, just like your ISP was. And there's a lot of hard to verify claims around the privacy restrictions on that, where they'll say like, we don't do logging, but to function in any sort of way, there needs to be some logging. And there have been many cases where a VPN provider has said, we don't do any logging, but they get a request from the FBI that, oh, we think someone is using your VPN to access, you know, this site that is doing something that is morally reprehensible. Here is all the legal documentation for it. And so they are not logging everyone. They're logging that one person they got the request from the FBI for.
Really, really, right here with the question arises.
Well, and so And that's the case. And then the case is, how much does that go? Like, will they get a request, a legal request or a governmental request that says, hey, we would like to know everyone who's, you know, secretly watching Netflix from another country when they are actually in the US. Like, that's a bit below the area of concerns right now, but will it get to that point? I don't know. And it's more or less impossible to verify externally. That the level of access you would require to verify that is far beyond anything you could ever be granted, because you would be able to do all sorts of horrible things to their system if you were granted it. So it's tough to know. But for now, they're more, I think of them as like a polite fiction of security in a lot of cases. And you still have to try to see if they're a worthwhile thing. So
maybe we should follow up with some names of quote unquote reliable VPNs. For example, I've been using EncryptMe for years, was previously named Cloak, and I have no idea if they're really trustworthy, but they have trustworthy design, which matters for me, and Benedict recommended them. So these are two factors. Is it good enough?
I've never heard of them. I would actually recommend, there's a really neat open source application called Algo, and it's from Trail of Bits. And it lets you, it's basically a script you run. So this was going to fail your like trustworthy design aspects of this, but it would let you set up your own VPN off of a hosting provider. I think a level of reasonableness about the security, if you're really concerned about it, I think that's a really good way to go. Especially, I think you have a fairly technical audience. That's a reasonable kind of thing to do as far as the trade-offs.
And one last topic I'd love to cover, it's not directly relevant to our previous thread of discussion, but as SaaS founders, we do get from time to time incoming cold email from so-called, I don't know, hackers or whoever, who have found some vulnerabilities in our systems, and they're looking for bounties. So give us an overview of how that works, and if really fellow SaaS founders should be aware, afraid, or not caring about these type of requests?
I think the answer is it depends. Well, I don't think you should be afraid of them. It would be the first step, in that this is usually under the term of security research, that there's security researchers who are people that go out and, you know, look for vulnerabilities in websites. And then the other term, and this is an industry term, this isn't really a technical term, but it's called responsible disclosure, that they found XYZ, you know, vulnerability in your software or in Chrome or in Facebook. And they take that to the organization and say, hey, we found this. Here's the steps to replicate. Just want to make you aware of this. And almost like, would you be willing to provide me, you know, some compensation for this? Now, a lot of larger organizations have a full-on bug bounty program. And these can be quite lucrative, like tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in part, it's an economic response to people selling bugs, that, you know, there is an actual market that if you're able to find some zero-day bug that no one knows about that could be used against Chrome users, could be used against the iPhone, you could sell that for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And there's organizations that basically are a marketplace for those and buy them and use them for all sorts of not great purposes. And so this is sort of a counter to that. So I think it would be tough to be in your spot as a non-developer and deal with these. I guess a couple things. One, a very low-cost way to start with this is to at least have a security at your company, at your domain.com email address that you pay attention to, and that that's posted on the website. Like, hey, security issues. Like, you can find this on the expedited security site, that if someone finds an issue, we have a direct line to me that says, here is who you contact, and that that's posted so that it's not lost in the shuffle. I think then I would recommend acknowledging it, like responding to them and saying, hey, thank you for finding this. We just want to, you know, verify that this is true. Talk to your developer about it. And the developer will have some sense of this, because I have seen everything reported from very serious issue that was potentially, you know, exposing user data for, you know, tens of thousands of people, to, well, it's an API. That's just how APIs work. And everything in between has been reported. And, you know, it's very fair, I think, to give some token or some credit to the person. Like, I don't think that's a crazy thing. I think that's pretty reasonable.
Thank you for the tips. That's been useful. So far, we've been successful at applying some basic top-level social common sense to, you know, receiving generic requests that don't even make any sense. So that these are pretty easy to filter out. But yeah, it's great to know what to do on the next level of complexity. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom today, for bringing up this topic. Where can people find you, your products, your writing online?
If you're interested in using expedited WAF, we're on the Heroku Marketplace. You can find us there. If you want to reach me directly, the best place is probably Twitter at mbuckby.
Thank you so much again for your time, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
All right. Thank you so much, Jane.